Well, good morning, everyone. This is a thank you. This is quite a turnout for Mother's Day. I'm very impressed. Bless you all for coming out on a day when it is a bit hard to get out the door with breakfast in bed and so on, which I didn't have. So never mind. Peter told me your church has a series going on 1 Corinthians, and I offered, when you get to it, to do chapter 5. As I have some material on it. I'll read you the 13 verses in chapter 5, and I can tell you now, it's not very pleasant reading. The text is up here from the NRSV. I don't know what version this is, but it'll be more or less the same. It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that is not found even among pagans, for a man is living with his father's wife. And you are arrogant. Should you not rather have mourned so that he who has done this would have been removed from among you? For though absent in body, I am present in spirit, and as if present, I have already pronounced judgment in the name of the Lord Jesus on the man who has done such a thing. When you are assembled and my spirit is present with the power of our Lord Jesus, you are to hand this man over to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, so that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord. Your boasting is not a good thing. Do you not know that a little yeast leavens the whole batch of dough? Clean out the old yeast so that you may be a new batch, as you really are unleavened. For our Paschal lamb, that's the Passover lamb, Christ has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the festival not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral persons, not at all meaning the immoral of this world, or the greedy and robbers or idolaters, since you would then need to go out of the world. But now I am writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother or sister, who is sexually immoral or greedy, or is an idolater, reviler, drunkard or robber. Do not even eat with such a one. For what have I to do with judging those outside? It is not those who are inside. Is it not those who are inside that you are to judge? God will judge those outside. Drive out the wicked person from among you. Oh my goodness. Okay, here goes. Right, so this is a very difficult and unpleasant passage, and it seems to be saying that Christians must uphold very strict moral standards over each other and hold public meetings to condemn sinners among them and to judge and shun them and even drive them out.
Can we have it louder?
No,
Now, this may have once been common practice, even only 50 years ago for churches, but it isn't acceptable now. So what do we do? Do we throw out this and other similar New Testament passages? Well, I will do my best this morning to explain how Paul may have been misinterpreted and was actually far less censorious than it appears here. Paul, like Jesus, seems sensitive to the fact that we are creatures of emotion and that personal offence or violation can be fatal to our connection to community and even to our faith. We have a lot of trouble overlooking insults, neglect, theft, disapproval, betrayal, and embarrassment. So let's look at a tricky situation in the first century church in Corinth. We actually don't know enough about it to make a full commentary. The sketchy details are that there is sexual immorality among you. A man is living with his father's wife. Now, the word for sexual immorality is porneia. Strictly, it means prostitution, but then it was taken in a general sense by Hellenistic culture to just mean basically any sexual immorality. And where it says a man is living with his father's wife, there isn't living with in the original, it just says that a man has his father's wife, which is a euphemism for sexual relations. Okay, we don't know very much more about it. What are the possibilities? The son's mother, is she alive or dead? That would have been his father's first wife, we presume. The father's present wife, is she slave or free? This is a very relevant question in first century Corinth. Was she young or old? Were the father and this wife already divorced? Is the father a Christian? Is the son a Christian? Is the woman a Christian? We just don't know. So we've sort of delivered this, they've delivered this flat text, you know, with shock horror, and, you know, we don't really know what's going on. But, of course, Paul and the church in Corinth did. So now we can examine Paul's comments to see where he stands. If the follow-up over in 2 Corinthians, which is the next letter to the Corinthians, is about the same case, and it may not be, but if it is, it says, Paul says, "So although I wrote to you, the Corinthians, it was not on account of the one who did the wrong, nor on account of the one who was wronged, but in order that your dedication for us might be made known to you before God." So we see that Paul considers the son has done wrong, and the father has been wronged, and he's seems to be unconcerned about the woman's role in the matter, which means that she may not have been a Christian and was therefore outside of his realm of concern, as he says in this same chapter. It's not my job to judge those who are outside the church. But overall, Paul is much more concerned about the attitude of the church and how they handle this tricky situation in their midst. Now, even with these sketchy details, something about them is rather strange. This text is sometimes called the incest chapter, when few of us would actually recognise it as such. After all, the son and his father's wife are not blood relatives, and the woman is presumably of mature age. So we have to ask an obvious question, which has been asked by William Ramsay, an archaeologist and New Testament scholar from the early 20th century, quite a long time ago. He says this: "Would ordinary society in Corinth have been shocked and outraged at a marriage between a man and the second wife of his father? No one who has studied the state of Greek society will answer that question in the affirmative. Everyone knows that there was not in those cities such strictness of moral judgment." Okay. Now what? Corinthian morality. It was a large port city in Greece. It had two harbours. It had a temple to Aphrodite, the goddess of love. It hosted the Ischium Games, which was sort of like a Commonwealth Games scenario. It openly sanctioned brothels and considered them to be supportive of family life. And the Corinthian population were intellectually astute, financially wealthy, and morally corrupt, in that they pretty much did what they liked, and there wasn't a very strong rule of law. So, this is another comment from Ramsay. "Greek custom and law has always been very lax as to restrictions on marriage. Marriage of uncle and niece or aunt and nephew has always been freely permitted in Athens. Stepbrother and stepsister might contract marriage with one another if their relationship were through their father, though not if it were through the mother. It would be hard to find proof of any Greek objection to this Corinthian marriage, even in the strictest period of Greek morality, if there ever was any strict period. In short, the Corinthian church, when it condoned this crime, was simply judging as the Corinthians had always judged, and it was not sinking below the pagan level. It was standing contentedly on that level." Right, well, when it says that this is, immorality is not named among the pagans, or not so much as named among the Gentiles, depending on which version you're reading, we only have two words, not named. And they're fairly straightforward. So any translation that says, and they all pretty much say it, you know, not so much as named among the Gentiles, is actually overstated and misleading. In the light of the Corinthian culture, it is more likely that it was not named as a crime. So what the Corinthian church was therefore dealing with was an indistinct borderline moral issue which would not be considered a judicial matter in Corinth. The father could not take his son to court. There's no grounds for doing that. And yet, it was very offensive to the Christian father, whose Christian son had taken up with his presumably non-Christian wife. So the shocking taboo of a son marrying his father's wife didn't consist in any perversion in the act itself, but in the circumstances of their relationship as father and son and as Christians, and the shame and the offence it generates for the father. The son seems to have had the attitude of, too bad, this is how it is, Dad, deal with it. Some fathers would. This one couldn't. It would be good if he could, but he couldn't. The father felt shamed, rejected, and mocked. I'm proposing that this is the case. And this would probably be far greater in an Eastern shame honour culture than in the Western guilt innocence culture. Now, we can test the morality of this scenario if we imagine a best case scenario, because I'd say this is the worst case, because the father's very not happy. How about a best case scenario? Just say the Christian father had a much younger pagan wife. Or two. The marriage had not proved to be very satisfactory to either of them. She and his son had fallen in love, and the father had decided it wouldn't be such a bad thing to release this wife to his son, who had now married her. No extreme offence, no shame, just pragmatism. Now, this isn't ideal, of course, but just remember that there were very few Christian marriages in the first century. Just about everybody was a convert, and they came as they were. With or without their spouses. We can also imagine a similar modern situation. Just imagine this, and you know, it might be rare. We're a divorced couple who have both remarried. They have amiable access to the children. They've well and truly moved on with their emotions, and neither of them would be particularly concerned if they were both, all of them, in the same church. The church consults with them all and welcomes the returning spouse and his current wife. That's if, you know, he'd left in the meantime, which is quite likely. And in this case, as with the 1 Corinthians 5 case, the problem is not specifically the breakup and the realliance, although that is not an ideal situation. It was possibly very painful at the time. But it is the emotional state of both parties, what they can and what they can't deal with in the here and now. And that's where a lot of our problems in community come, isn't it? And we've all been through some of those things. Now, let's have a look. There were all sorts of moral conundrums for the early Christians in Greco-Roman society. Some terrible things. You know, it must have been terrible for the churches to deal with this, that if they converted a slave, that slave could well be in an ongoing abuse situation from their master, male or female. Homosexual, heterosexual abuse situation. Their marriages were not recognised. The master could sell one or the other and they would never hear from them again. Infant exposure was the most common form of birth control, and if the master decided that he did not want the slave's child, didn't want to raise it, just put it out in the rubbish heap. There was polygamy, adultery, real incest, and so on. And in many of these instances, the moral judgment or rescue of a Christian was out of reach for the church. All they could provide was support. Right, now, what were the father's options? Presuming he was very offended. Could he sue at law? Well, we've already established he couldn't. had that murder or retribution that was a common resort in Corinth? Well, it's his son, and he's a Christian. How about disinheriting him? Well, we don't know the circumstances. He may be an only son, there may be no other options, the father may not have been that vindictively minded, and as a Christian, he's told not to avenge himself. Now, lots of people found themselves in a situation in the first century where they had basically no power in a matter of great offence. But there was always one last recourse in pagan society, and that was to go to the temple with a gift, a sacrifice, and to invoke the judgment of the gods upon the offender. Basically, a ritual curse. Physical affliction was expected if the person was guilty, usually a subterranean fever, you know, that would burn in the person, and it could have been anything, you know. Infection was probably quite common. Financial ruin, all sorts of things could be imprecated upon the person. And there are numerous examples of dedications and inscriptions in these temples that demonstrate that this is what people did for the in a powerless situation in the case of offence. Now, imprecation was feared and respected as a very effective way of revenge. Excuse me, I'm about to cough. Right. This is another quote from Ramsay, who I found very helpful on this, and a lot of other commentators have not brought out this, well, they have, none of them have brought out this possibility. He says, these forms of imprecation played a great part in ancient life, and many examples of them have been preserved to our time. We find divine wrath and punishment is thus invoked against thieves, slanderers, poisoners, assassins, an adopted child who has raised his hand against his foster mother, users of false weights, persons who refuse to restore money deposited in their case, and so on. And even a mere advertisement of lost property was accompanied by a curse, consigning to divine punishment anyone that found it did not restore the lost article. So, what does Paul recommend? He recommends that the community get together and they have a solemn meeting in which Paul claims to be present by the Spirit, and that they deliver the offender to Satan. Now, the Christians, more than most people, are probably powerless to get any justice, aren't they? Because there's so many things they won't do. But this is something that Paul thinks they can do. And it's a Christianized version of invoking the gods. Paul mentions this one other time also in 1 Timothy 1, where he says, among them are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have turned over to Satan, that they may learn not to blaspheme. Satan here is seen as God's agent, not God's enemy. And we know that Satan in the Hebrew means an adversary, someone who is opposed to anyone, you, me, God, the government, Jesus in the New Testament. And the church surrenders an offender to God for rebuke, affliction, and instruction. Now, I don't know quite how likely it is for everyone in life to come to this situation, but sometimes there is such an offence in life, such a crisis, and you are so powerless to do anything about it, and you have no recourse, no retribution, no satisfaction at all, that the only thing you can really do is pray to God that God will vindicate you or teach the offending person a better way in life, whatever that takes. That's actually an imprecatory prayer, and it's not something you would recommend to do for every little thing, but I've certainly come to that situation in my life. That prayer's still out there, and I've let it go, and it's God's business. And I think that that's actually quite a healthy thing to do. And, you know, we know in the Psalms, there's a lot of imprecatory Psalms where the psalmist curses his enemies. And yet he doesn't seek to retribute himself. He passes it over to God. And here are two quotes, one in the Old Testament, one in the New. Vengeance is mine and recompense. And God promises that I will vindicate my people, I will have compassion on my servants. And in Romans 12, beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, and I will repay. And Paul in Romans is quoting Deuteronomy. Paul wasn't very happy with how the church handled this. He says, you are arrogant. Should you not rather have mourned? Your boasting is not a good thing. Do you not know the little yeast leavens the whole batch of dough? What were they boasting about, do you think? Boasting that the son had done this and this was great? I don't think so.
That they were socially relevant?
Yes, I think that they were very pleased with themselves about how tolerant they were, how broad-minded. But they didn't realise it was a cost, and the cost was to the father. And this is something we really have to think about. They dismissed the father's need for justice and support. They were on a side issue. They were unconcerned with the church's reputation as being, you know, a godly place. And they were insensitive to this father's possible alienation. Paul comes back at 100 miles an hour and contends that the Christians are not free from moral law, being free from law, yes, but free from moral law in the sense that we know we aim for and manifest the best. They were not free from the body. This was a Gnostic view that didn't matter what you did with the body or in your relationships, it was your spirit that counted to God and you could do whatever you liked. And he said that they're not free from communal concern for one another, and they were not free from responsibility to the reputation of the gospel. Right, so with church response to offence, it isn't the business of just one or two. Some problems do affect the whole community. The ultimate aim is restoration and not judgment. And the problem is not so much the facts of the case, you know, who's having off with whom or who's abandoned whom or, you know, all those details. Often where the rubber really hits the road is the emotional state of the parties and what they can or can't deal with in the here and now. And it is to that that the church needs to be sensitive. And sometimes people just need space and time apart. Now, has anyone got any suggestion as to what the church could have asked the son or the father to do that would have helped the situation? Mama. Okay. Yes? I think I said that it wasn't clear whether the wife, the son's mother... you know, not that that really matters, I suppose, but she was the first wife.
It doesn't matter because if the father was there, then he married the father's wife after he was done. In that regard...
Yeah, well, clearly he wasn't dead because then it wouldn't be a problem. And also, in 2 Corinthians 7, Paul talks about the one who was wronged and the one who wronged him. So it indicates, as far as we can tell, that... that this is the current situation between two members.
The father was dead because there were very strong Jewish laws about who the widow could marry.
Yes, except we're in Corinth.
Yeah, but Paul isn't.
I think Paul was writing from Ephesus.
Yeah, but he has that.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Generally, Paul is sensitive enough to deal with the Gentiles as Gentiles and the Jews as Jews, and you see him change those hats as he goes. These Corinthians would not have related at all to Jewish moral law. That they wouldn't have even probably known about a lot of it. There are certain principles that come over, but the rigidity of who you could and couldn't marry had long disappeared in Gentile society. Yes.
The question, if I'm rephrasing that, is how do we as a community look after both the person who has been wrong and the person who's done the wrong?
Yep.
Paul seems to be taking a very strong view. Is when you sort out the person who's done the wrong doing. Is that what he's saying?
Well, we'll get to that. It does appear to say that, and I'm just going to challenge that a bit. Yes?
It occurs to me that the importance of truth, like actually
true rather than working on assumptions?
It's always good to be fully informed, and we're not fully informed in this case. As under the listed, we just don't know what's really happened.
And the community
I'd say they probably were at least familiar with the people involved and their histories. But when are we ever fully informed about what really goes on, you know, in people's marriages? You know, we want a bullet point list of, you know, rights and wrongs, don't we?
I'm just thinking, I mean, you never know all the facts. You never do. You never, there are two sides to every story, and I'm just imagining the conflict that people, some people must have been in, if they had relationships with both those people. How do you hold both those people up? And I would imagine that part of the challenge of the church, particularly if it's a question of offence, is not to take sides. How do you do that in a way that is respectful of where both people are coming from? I'd be easing up on the church. That's a really good news.
I know. Yeah. So true.
But it doesn't matter if it was within the law or not. I was wrong. And how the church responds to that, if they have all the truth, but there is still someone who's saying, but this isn't fair.
Yes. Yeah. So this is the work of wisdom, isn't it, to transcend the details. If, you know, I'm not talking about transcending the details in the case of something terrible. You know, we won't go there, but you know some really terrible things. I'm talking about transcending the details when there is a significant difference of opinion and vested interests and so on. Yeah, Peter?
On Paul's point again, one of the things that Paul's dealing in this lesson with is factionalism.
Yes.
And nothing will spark factionalism quite as much as a
scandal.
Like this, when people start taking sides.
Yes.
And it causes terrible troubles.
Yeah.
Just a question. In the Greek, do they have exclamation marks?
No.
Because we've got an exclamation mark there in the text after the word arrogant. The word arrogant seems to have a lot of strength. But Paul's upsetness is not, as you say, with the facts. His upsetness is with the arrogance of people. And someone in the English language has decided to put an exclamation mark in there.
And it's an abrupt kind of sentence, isn't it? I mean, it's only a few words of a thing. Look, I think Paul's problem with the church was that they weren't trying at all. They had decided in their wisdom, oh, and these things, just keep right out of it and just carry on. You don't worry about how people are feeling, where they're up to, how it's affecting them in their personal and spiritual lives, you know. Not my business. And there is some argument to be made for that, but, you know, let's hold that ambivalence and continue. Right, well, yeast again. Because when I was here last time, I happened to talk about yeast. Paul complains that they're boasting. I did ask what that was. I think the boasting, I think Ken might have mentioned, or I'm not sure who, the boasting was to do with they thought they were doing a great job in handling it, and they weren't, and they were very complacent. And at the very end of the chapter in verse 13, he says, drive out the evil from among you. Now, nearly all the translations put in the word person or one, but it isn't there. So it doesn't say drive out the evil person or the wicked one. It just says drive out the evil from among you. And I think there is a case to be made that the evil is the arrogance and boasting and not the offending man. Paul says nothing about reversing the sexual alliances. He doesn't give advice and say, all right, you've got to give her back to the father and you have to, you know, restore to him, whatever. Paul is very pragmatic about the outcomes of people's emotional romantic choices, but he's not happy with how they were dealing with it. Now, this is a very difficult situation because having ironed the chapter out so far as best as we can, there follows a very awkward and unpleasant section about shunning immoral people in the church. I read that thing, I won't read it again. What do we think about that? We remember that Jesus ate with any and all who invited him, but now Paul requires commitment and accountability within the community. He goes on to add slanderer and drunkard to the vice lists. He has quite a long vice list. And the problem of how to interact with scandals inside the church is a very vexed one. My experience shows that shunning others for undesirable behaviour tends to be counterproductive. Have you tended to find this? And yet we all do it. There are people I won't have anything to do with, and there are people that won't have anything to do with me, despite me making regular approaches to them, you know, offering anything, to apologise, whatever. Absolutely not. Absolutely inflexible, they have nothing to do with me. If you shun someone, that offender becomes then offended and responds negatively to the notion that you think that you're better than them. And they will characterise your attitude as judgmental, superior, and even hypocritical. And they may be driven even further from a desire to reform their habits and to live for Christ. So even though we probably will all do it to a certain degree, if only to protect ourselves from being confronted by things that we can't deal with and don't like, we probably just need to remember that, you know, using behaviour modification on people by shunning them has to be applied with great caution and soul searching, so that at least we can say we haven't done any harm. Now, once upon a time, I think, and in this case, I think, that the withdrawal of goodwill and hospitality from someone was very effective. The Christians were a lonely, persecuted lot for quite a while. They needed each other, and they needed to be accepted by each other. These days, the church is fragmental and has moved a long way from that time, and people don't feel the same degree of grief and longing and shame and a desire to be restored. But I think it would have been okay, and this is my suggestion, it would have been okay for the church to, you know, talk to both parties and then say to the son, look, we owe some loyalty to your dad. Okay? He isn't dealing with this very well. If he leaves here, he has nowhere to go. You're the one who has removed something from him that he values. It appears in that situation that he has lost and you have won something which you both want. You need to perhaps go to another house church for a while. You need to give him space, both in community and in family. And I don't think that would have been out of order for the church to say that. And I think in that situation, presuming that these people can both still keep coming to church a couple of times a week as they were, and see each other across the room, and father see the son there with his wife, I don't think that would work. And I don't think that it is reasonable for us to expect that to work. Does anyone have any comments on that? Yeah?
I have a bit of a problem because I'm assuming we live society the same as Jewish. If one person divorced a man divorced a woman. So if she's a divorced woman, the father divorced him. So then you start asking about under what circumstances did he divorce her? Did he divorce her because she's having an affair with his son? Possibly.
Could be.
So the woman in that sense is incapable of divorcing. Under the law, women can't divorce. In Greek society, women were not citizens, so I'm assuming they couldn't divorce. So it's not like today when either party can divorce. It was not so. So that's a problem to me. So the father must have divorced her. Now you could well say the father divorced her and an object to her marrying his son in terms of major anyway. But that raises another set of questions to me, rather than saying that she divorced the father in order to become the parent's son.
Yeah, I hear you. There's a lot of questions unanswered. If the father had divorced her, I really can't see how he could have objections. That's my Western modern opinion. I have read that divorce was starting to become quite common in Greek society by the first century and was initiated by the new woman because, you know, a lot of freedoms were being advanced. Anyway, I can see a few people looking at their watches, so I'll leave that there. I just leave this up for discussion. I'm happy to discuss this with anyone afterwards. I'm not claiming to have all the answers to this chapter. It's a very difficult chapter. And it does appear to be saying one thing, and I'm trying to tell you it actually might actually say totally the other. But maybe today we've all had a bit of think anyway about some of these very difficult issues. I've certainly experienced them in church. I've experienced them in family. I'm actually going through something like this in my family right now, which is tremendously distressing. And I'm not probably behaving very well. So, you know, I'm not here to tell you how to be or what to do. We all have to make our own judgment calls. The thing is that when we deliver someone to Satan or to God or to Jesus or to cosmic justice, it's actually probably a good thing. We're probably letting go of our own desire for revenge. We are entrusting God with justice. And we are bringing relief and release to ourselves. Thank you.
Have any comments, questions?
Sorry, as you were talking, I just kept thinking about this very public Royal Commission that's unfolding into, you know, issues with Catholic orders, but other institutions as well. Just what can happen if it's not dealt with? The culture changes where, you know, that sort of sexual immorality becomes, as I suspect will come out that in some instances, you know, just wasn't dealt with and we actually reverted the culture.
You mean it became institutional?
Well, it became sort of accepted.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they might, you know, the brothers might get together and do it. You know, it's horrible. Where it hasn't really been dealt with. It's probably an example of what Paul sometimes, you know, I think he's addressing the seriousness of things, and you know, if you don't deal with it, it just can go from bad to worse.
And for sure.
And you know, see what sort of 10, 20, 50 years later, what's coming out now.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for that. In this case, I'd like to draw a bit of a line between, you know, sex with minors and a mutual choice between the son and his father's wife. We presume, unless she was a totally disempowered slave wife, which she may well have been, and was just told what to do. And I don't like that scenario either. But, you know, in this case, you know, abusing children who cannot consent and wouldn't consent, most definitely they wouldn't, is a long way removed from this particular case. And that's why it's so interesting that this is called the incest chapter, and yet it really is hardly along that scale at all, is it? Yeah.
Because what the Catholic brothers have done is been arrogant in the sense
that
they have put preserving their status and situation and whatever ahead of looking after the victims.
So true.
I can well imagine someone seeing the situation, and that's what Paul's condemning. In other words, they have the only justice, but just to stand up and fight for their own rights.
Yeah, the thing is, in those days, people didn't know, did they? They didn't know about it.
The one in power is the one who can run the system. The less powerful one is the one who has to corrupt it.
No. No, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, dear. Strongly appreciate you sharing that with us.